From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. The opening sentence of Rex Reed's column this week was, "When 2005 is over, the movie I will remember that gave me the most pure and unfiltered joy is Mrs. Henderson Presents." The film, which opens Friday the 9th at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas and the Angelica, stars Judi Dench and Bob Hoskins. It's directed by Stephen Frears, and it's the story of the Windmill Theatre, the only theatrical venue in London's West End that stayed open day and night throughout World War II and the Blitz. It gives me great pleasure now to welcome back to my show Stephen Frears and Dame Judi Dench. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
I remember the Windmill Theatre from when I was a student in London, 1960-61. It was considered a pretty seedy place then, wasn't it? And in fact, the whole Soho area was. Do you remember it, Judi?
I do remember it. I think in 61, probably it was a bit seedy, but I think everybody in Britain knew about the Windmill and probably knew that Vivian Van Damme ran it. Mm-hmm. But what is exciting for us is that nobody seemed to know about Laura Henderson.
Well, had you heard of her before you read the script?
Never. Never at all. No, she was just this eccentric British lady who used her money and bought a theatre she knew nothing about.
And in the film, it's Mrs. Henderson who comes up with the idea of putting naked girls on stage. Was that true? After all, we're talking about a 69-year-old philanthropist who was from the aristocracy, typical of her class in the 30s, a terrible snob. Isn't it a bit surprising, Stephen, that she'd be the person to suggest a nude review?
Well, she's a very sparky woman who endlessly comes up with original ideas. I mean, the idea of buying a theatre at that time must have been very extraordinary.
You said that she's the most appalling right-wing woman, an absolute shocker, but I respect defending the indefensible. Was that part of the appeal here?
That becomes one's life, really, to defend the indefensible.
Well, there have been any number of films in which you've done something like that, but this is a bit off the track for you, isn't it?
Well,
all these musical numbers.
It involves a lot of singing and dancing, which I've never done before. Mm. Yes, that was a tremendous, daunting challenge.
As I understand it, before you ever got involved, Bob Hoskins and Norma Hyman, who produced the film, felt that there was only one actress for the role of Mrs. Henderson. Norman said she wanted the real Judi, the mischievous, naughty, very sexy Judi, the practical joker, the charmer. And you said that she's the most mischievous woman in the world. So, Judi, do you see yourself?
He also thinks I'm the silliest woman in the world, too.
How do you see yourself? Are you all of those things?
I suppose I am all of those things. But then if we were doing Macbeth, I'd say I was all of those things as well.
I'd probably stay away from you if you were doing Macbeth under those circumstances.
She is a killer.
Well, I noticed you still haven't washed those spots out. But... Stephen, haven't you said that at first you were mystified by the story? What was so mystifying about it for you?
No, I don't know that I said it was mystifying.
You said you could...
It was very difficult.
You said the idea of making a film about the windmill and about the naked girls you thought would be very funny, but you kept on wondering if there was a story.
Well, I didn't... I was really asked... I was taken out to lunch and just was told that Judi and Bob would like me to direct them in this film. I didn't actually know quite what it was about, and they kept trying to explain it to me. Mm-hmm. And I never really understood, so I was mystified until I read the script that Martin Sherman wrote.
And you knew that you wanted Stephen to direct?
We did. We
You'd worked with him in television, but nothing else.
Yes, twice before. Yes, we did think that. I mean, It's just, I think people disbelieve the story, really. I think, but it was absolutely all fact. And it's worth telling, you know. It's amazingly courageous at that time that they did that kind of thing. Not only that she bought the theatre and Vivian Van Damme ran it, but those girls, you know, they did three continuous performances a day, during the Blitz in London and during all the air raids and things. It's great courage it shows.
Actually, it starts off when Mrs. Henderson buys the theater. She tries legitimate plays, then films. In fact, I gather Marlene Dietrich.
That was really before she bought the theater. It had been a cinema and perhaps a legitimate theater.
But then when she took it over, she hired Vivian Van Damme, and he came up with an idea called Revue de Ville.
That's right. It was a sort of literally a non-stop review. It was just going round and round the whole time.
And that was a big success, but
That was a big success, so much so that all the other theatres started doing it. So it took their audience away.
So why add the nude girls? How did she come up with that? Had she been to the Moulin Rouge in Paris?
I think she knew about that. I think a lot of people knew about that and how, the reason for going to Paris was seeing this amazingly risque review. But I think also she knew she could do it because she was a friend of the Lord Chamberlain.
Because England was rather constrained on sexual matters in those days. Even later, in the 60s, you had to join a club if
absolutely.
You wanted
to see
certain movies.
Yes, or all
I'm
the
not talking about porn
and things,
either.
Yes. I know all the scripts that we had were censored when I came into the theatre in 57.
I remember seeing Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and it was in a club. You couldn't see it in a regular theatre. You had to be a member of a club.
So it was amazingly, not so much shocking as daring thing to do.
I understand that Joan Littlewood, the great director, was arrested because a man in one of her Stratford East productions walked across the stage carrying a plank in a suggestive manner.
That was the famous thing, yes.
Things ain't what they used to be, wasn't it?
I remember the thing from the Chamberlain is that the man couldn't walk across the stage carrying a plank in a suggestive
manner. In that manner.
Absolutely.
It makes you wonder whether there will always be in England, although the country's changed so much.
Well, it's
since.
A very... what this solution that you could have naked girls, but they weren't allowed to move. It's a very, very English, slightly idiotic sort of solution to the problem.
And that was something that Mrs. Henderson came up with the Lord Chamberlain?
Yes. He insisted, she just wanted naked girls all prancing around. He said, you can have the naked girls, but they can't prance about. They must, they must be in a tableau, and they were, wonderfully. They were art forms, really.
If they were still, it was art. If they moved, it was disgusting.
Because it was art, because it was like a painting, a nude painting at the British Museum.
That's right.
At the National Gallery, actually.
That's right, yes.
And they did these things around themes like mermaids, American Indians, Annie Oakley, Britannia. After a while, it got all very patriotic, didn't
it? Yes.
Naked,
especially
but
during
British.
The war, as that scene with the Marseillaise and Tom Allen singing and... That must have been very stirring.
Mm. Now, Christopher Guest plays Lord Cromer, the Lord Chamberlain, whose job it was to censor, and that went into the 60s. He's best known as a wonderful comic actor in This is Spinal Tap, and also the director of Best in Show. But I was surprised some years ago to learn that he's a member of the British aristocracy. That why you cast
he
him?
He is a toff. He's the real thing. Yes, of course. Absolutely.
The fifth Baron Haydon Guest of Sailing.
I wouldn't expect me to cast anybody less.
So, since so much of this is about having the right connections, was he cast because he had the right connections?
Absolutely. And also was very, very talented and very, very funny.
And it must be a lot of fun to work with somebody like him.
It was.
Because you have some great scenes with him.
It was enormous fun. Just enormous. Especially in front of Buckingham Palace on the lawn.
My guests are Dame Judi Dench and Stephen Frears. The new film Mrs. Henderson Presents is opening this next Friday the 9th at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas and the Angelica, and already has gotten a rave review from Rex Reed. He says it's almost 2 hours of relentless, heart-pounding pleasure. You like reviews.
Can I go now? I have nothing else to say.
This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So they got past the censors, but despite the nudity, there's something rather innocent about the Windmill shows. And I understand that today the club has been changed, and now there's a club there that has lap dances. Which
what happened was really
quite different.
That strip clubs came in, and which made the whole thing slightly pointless. So that when you talk about it being seedy, that's what was going on around 1960.
Didn't you meet some of the original Windmill girls?
Oh, they're magnificent. I mean, still alive and kick, and I mean, they would
and
kick
kicking.
If they, that's right. They'd kick if they could. No, they're heroic, and they all talked about, you know, this time of innocence and that it was like a family. And they just had such affectionate memories of the time.
But wasn't it considered immoral to appear nude on the stage?
Well, I was always on the lookout for, you know, because I'm sort of modern-ish. They were, you know, you're looking for stories of exploitation and some other angle on it. I never heard a word from any of them.
Is it true that your writer researched every script that The Windmill did?
If you say so.
Well, that's what I read.
I didn't know that story, but he's very, very thorough.
Well, this is it doesn't adhere exactly to the facts of the story, does it?
Well, the time is compressed because, you know, if it goes over too long a time, then you have to have all those questions of sort of aging people down, which didn't seem terribly interesting. But otherwise, I think it's what happened.
Did you, Judy, did you watch any of the previous films about the Windmill Theater and Vivian Van Damme? There was the Hollywood one, Tonight and Every Night, starring Rita Hayworth as a windmill girl, although I imagine there was no mention of nudity in a Hollywood film in 1945.
I saw clips of Vivian Van Damme talking to the girls and, you know, just delightful. Mm-hmm. What an attractive man. And like Stephen, we had this wonderful time when we met all the girls who are now in their 90s, you know, taking ballet classes in the morning, they are, age 91. And we talked to them a lot about it and about their life there and the fact, as Stephen says, that she really treated them as a family that she'd lost and paid for weddings and just looked after them generally. And, the thing about getting disguised and getting back into the theatre is absolutely a fact. She had the best makeup man in London. She got in actually looking like a man at one point.
This is one eccentric woman.
It's one eccentric woman, but worth telling her story.
In a country of many eccentric women.
But she went in as a man because she wanted to know... Because most of the audience in those days were men, weren't they?
But she wanted to check up that they were all being... You know, she'd been banned from the theatre by Vivian Van Damme because of being so impossible, getting in the way. And so she got back to see that they were all being treated properly.
You'd think it was an audience of men, but actually Bob Hoskins was taken as a child by his family. Mm-hmm. When he
I
was
never
five.
Heard of children.
And any number
no, he
of,
went as a child with his family.
And I read that some members of royalty would go by. I guess it was the daring thing to do, to go to the windmill.
Yes.
But there's also the other side of this story. Bob Hoskins says that it started out as a story about a theater, and then it wound up, without trying, to be one of the most potent anti-war films he's ever seen.
Well, the war breaks out halfway through, and in that rather English way. I mean, because she lost a son in the war, Judy's character speaks very eloquently about, you know, about the ridiculousness of, about the valueless of how awful it is to lose a son and how it isn't sort of worth anything. Of course, the war that was being fought was a very decent war and had to be fought.
Well, the Windmill was the only theatre in London that stayed open throughout the war, except for, I understand, 12 compulsory days in 1939. And they put up a sign saying, "We never closed."
That's right. Or "We never...
We are
never
closed."
We never stopped the girls taking their clothes off inside.
we never closed.
But London, yes. But London was bombed for 59 nights in a row.
And because the theater was below ground, could continue.
The bombs couldn't get that far down.
It was a safe place. Better for them to stay there, really, than go home. Safer.
Girls used to sleep there. And I would meet people who said, "Oh, no, I used to sleep under the stage."
Really?
Well, the streets
better
were,
than going to the
streets
underground.
Were more dangerous than staying there.
And also, it was obviously a place that soldiers, military people anyway,
well, it became,
on leave could
blow
some steam.
It became very, very successful in the war because London was full of young men waiting for the invasion of Europe, both English and a lot of Americans. And they started going there because young men are what they are.
Judy, as I said earlier, you requested Stephen as the director of this film, and then he had you row up and down a river 30 times on the first day of shooting in England.
How long does that show for in the film? About 2.5 minutes.
What was wrong with the rowing until
Quite.
Then?
Quite. What was wrong with the rowing? You can ask him directly. It was just either I was too fast or I was too slow, or the Leander Club, which raced past me, were too fast or too slow or not on cue, and the man who handed me the megaphone. It was a whole day on the Thames. I was in a steaming row at the end of it.
Most people will not ask Judi Dench to do that many takes.
Well, if that's the job. No, it's just trying to assemble elements, and when one of the elements moves like it's water, it's harder.
Well, I gather that's why when Bob Hoskins says that when he hadn't the faintest idea of what to do with his part or who to be, you said, you've got no problems. All you have to do is play me. And so he played this grumpy old man who was a pain in the butt, he said.
Well, he seems to have my number. All I really meant was that he was playing a man who... I was very curious why these girls... They were rather respectable girls there. They weren't strippers or whatever people take their clothes off. They were rather respectable girls, and I was curious why they took their clothes off, because it didn't seem to be poverty, and exhibitionism only accounts for a certain amount of it. So I assumed that Van Damme had some capacity to get girls to take their clothes off, and here was I making a film in which a lot of girls were taking their clothes off, so I couldn't help noticing the connection between him and me.
Van Damme wrote his autobiography. He never once mentioned that he was Jewish.
That's right, and that's what the writer, Martin Sherman, picked up on.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a key to his personality, the desire of a Dutch Jew, Jewish emigre, to be as British as any British person could be?
It's very, very mysterious. I mean, it's not really anti-Semitism. English people are very, very good at concealing things. The truth is that my mother turned out to be Jewish, and I only discovered that in my mid-20s, so...
She told you it in privacy?
I discovered it at her mother's 80th birthday. I suddenly discovered this. But when you look for, you know, you think, well, is this the result of anti-Semitism? I think it was much more to do with sort of rebelliousness against her parents. So those sort of things went on, that level of concealment.
But it's interesting. Mrs. Henderson knows that he's Jewish, and she both... makes anti-Semitic remarks throughout the film, and also has this great attraction for him.
She's deeply attracted to him from the moment she meets him. But I think she gently joshes him about it. I think it's not really a comment. It's saying, and you are, and what's more, you are. And, you know, so it's a kind of gentle teasing him, I suppose.
Well, but this is also about class. She is a member of the aristocracy of sorts, so at least she's upper class, and he is not a bit of a he's a bit of a vulgarian, and somehow they make this alliance, this unlikely alliance.
Attracted by opposites, perhaps. No.
I'm talking with Judi Dench and Stephen Frears about a new film called Mrs. Henderson Presents. It's opening next Friday, a week from tomorrow, at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas and the Angelica, and we will continue our conversation after this. And we're back with Judi Dench and Stephen Frears. She is the star, along with Bob Hoskins, of a new film called Mrs. Henderson Presents, which opens a week from tomorrow at Lincoln Plaza Cinemas and the Angelica. Stephen Frears is the director, as he has been of some of the finest films to come out of England for many years. I remember you all the way back to Gumshoe, which was the first, wasn't it?
Yes, that was the first one.
And everybody said, oh, where did this come from, I remember. Since then, I guess people are no longer surprised. But I asked earlier if this was a bit of a departure, because it's a musical, but it's not a musical. It's a comedy, but it's not a comedy. I don't know if you've done anything like that before.
Well, I haven't done anything like this, no. But, of course, what you're trying to find, and it's hard in small countries, is to find some story with some originality and some freshness and vitality. And, you know, when you find a script like that, you're very, very lucky, because there aren't other films being made like that. So it's a new way of, I suppose, talking about England, but it's a new way of interesting, firstly myself, and then the audiences.
Did you approach this, Judi, as a comic role?
I don't think I thought it was a comedy. I just thought, it's a, what a terrific story. And why have we not known about this? So there is. I mean, it's divinely written. It's a kind of gift to be given somebody like that to play. But it does take a kind of bittersweet quality about it. So there's a bit of everything in it.
Well, in the past, everybody focused on Van Damme because he was the one who put this all together. But this film really makes it clear that Mrs. Henderson was a key player in all of this, although she died before the end of the war.
1944, yes. And left the theater to him rather than to her family.
Mm-hmm. Did that shock people at the time?
I don't know whether it shocked them. It's an interesting fact that you kind of know about, you know. So maybe it was shocking, and it was there was immense speculation about whether or not, just how far their relationship went.
Years later, many of the greatest British comedians began at the Windmill. Was Van Damme responsible for bringing in Peter Sellers and Harry Seacombe and Tony Hancock and Kenneth Moore?
It was really after the war that happened, and all those people you've talked about, they came out of the services. So they'd seen, you know, they'd been fighting or, you know, they'd been in the services during the war and wanted to go on stage. And it was one of the ways of getting into the theatre. There was a huge turnaround. The truth is, the stories were always tragic because nobody wanted to hear the comedians. They wanted to see the girls. So it was always a sort of, you know, comedian's graveyard. But in fact, people who became very, very famous, I mean, Peter Sellers, I suppose, is the most famous.
Peter Sellers and Harry Seacombe, they go on to do the Goon Show.
That's right. So all these English comics somehow began there.
Tommy Cooper, I think, began there. Bruce Forsyth, yes.
Yes.
Michael Benteen.
So, must have been uphill, mustn't it, for them?
Well, many American comedians got started in burlesque, and then people say, get off, bring out the girls. I guess the same thing.
I imagine that's exactly what happened.
There are 14 musical numbers in the film, and you've joked that it's still not Singing in the Rain.
Well, nothing will be like Singing in the Rain, will it?
It was important to pick the right songs, wasn't it?
Yes.
There are any number of American songs, but there are also a number of British songs that are very much about the time.
Yes, that's right. That's right. No, they all sort of vaguely exist. Sometimes the music didn't exist, so we were able to rewrite the music and bring it and make it, I guess, slightly more acceptable to a modern audience.
I mean, finding the musical scores. Well, you use "Goody Goody," which was made famous in this country by Benny Goodman, as a theme throughout it. It changes the way they sing it at different times. Reflects the changes in.
Well, it's really. I was always very concerned that the musical number should somehow develop the narrative. It wasn't like a musical which stops and then you have a number. It always seemed to me that you had to keep the narrative going. And that was a rather good number because you could actually compress a lot of action into it and show off a lot of the tableaus.
And Judy, you didn't have to sing in this film. You didn't have to take off your clothes. So you...
Oh, I tried all that, but he wasn't having any. I got to show my shoulder. It's one very small, bare shoulder for a minute.
Will Young has a major role in this. This is his first film, isn't it?
Yes.
He became well-known in England because he won Pop Idol, which is the equivalent of American Idol in this country.
That's American Idol, I believe, came from Pop Idol.
And we're stealing all of the bad television shows from England, aren't we?
I'm ashamed to say you probably are.
I still am blaming Britain for reality shows.
Oh, no, we're blaming you.
Well, I guess both countries are equally culpable, unfortunately.
It's true.
So, and this guy really does sound like he grew up at the time. He's a kid, and yet he sounds just like in the late 30s.
Will came to see me, and I remember going backstage, back into the back room and saying, this chap seems rather good. And he did seem very appropriate to that time. He's a wonderful fellow and has a very good voice and is very bright. He was just a lucky find. But he is enormously popular, which, of course, makes you more cautious rather than anything else.
And then Thelma Barlow plays Lady Conway, Mrs. Henderson's friend. Everybody who watches British television, even in this country, knows Coronation Street, and she's been there forever. But this is her first film.
It's her first film. She never let on to me. I didn't know at all until just a couple of months ago.
Isn't that a rarity? I mean, you've gone back and forth throughout your career between television and film.
It's fantastic. It's just wonderful that that happened, that she's done it. I expect it'll be the first of masses of films she'll make now.
She's absolutely brilliant. Mm. Brilliant.
But Coronation Street, I guess, it could be a career in itself, after all. How long has it been?
She was in it for 1,000 years. She was in it for a long, long time. But I remember a woman saying to a woman who was also in it, saying, she's the really good one. She's really good. She can really do it.
You also, I'm sure, had to worry about authenticity. So often when you see films of this sort, they either get the hairstyles wrong or they go in the other direction, and you almost feel like you're watching a Madame Tussauds version of a historic event. What were some of the things that you had to do here?
I had to employ very, very talented people.
I gather that you had to tell forbid the tableau girls to exercise in the gym because they would look a little too buff for the 30s and 40s.
You couldn't have girls who were honed or just had spent a lot of time in the gym or had spent a lot of time in the sun. Girls appeared to be more rounded then, and no discipline had to be maintained.
He loved it. He loved it.
It was a real punishment.
And then directing dance routines. You hadn't done musical numbers before.
No, but again, you actually choose. We had a wonderful choreographer, wonderful woman called Eleanor Fazan, and she was a dancer herself and had done a lot of that. And knew, was from that period. She'd been a dancer 40 or 50 years ago, so she was incredibly helpful.
I was interested to note that The Windmill also has a connection to ballet. We talked about all those great comedians, but Van Damme paid for the formation of a ballet company that starred Alicia Markova, who was a sister of one of the Windmill girls.
That's right, and died very recently.
Doris Barry. Now, who had the fake name, Doris Barry or Alicia Markova?
No, Alicia Markova had the same. Alice Mark, she was always known as in my youth.
So in a way, Mrs. Henderson paid for what began as the Festival Ballet, is now known as the English National Ballet.
Yes, yes. I think she had a hand into Sadler's Wells as well.
Yes, and the girls used to say, we're paying for all of that.
How does this fit in, do you think, Judy, with other things that you've done? Or is every film, every television show, every theatrical production a thing in itself?
I think it is a thing in itself. When we were at Stratford and we were doing kind of 3 or 4 plays at a time in repertoire, people used to say to me, "Oh, how don't you get the plays muddled up?"
Isn't that the kind of question that people who don't act ask?
A lot. Yes, it is.
Because actors understand you.
Yes, because each thing carries its own atmosphere. Each thing carries its own memories. It's all separate in your mind, and it has, you know, it has, you have associations, having done one film with all sorts of other things. They are all in, you know, they are into compartments in your mind. So nothing is the same, and hopefully, you know, you. It's wonderful to get a part like that, and after you've done something like All's Well, which I did, The Countess in All's Well, you know, it's so totally different, and that's the joy of it and the luck of it.
My guests are Judy Dench and Stephen Frears. We're talking about a film called Mrs. Henderson Presents, which opens a week from tomorrow at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas and the Angelica. Well, I would assume, Stephen, that when you're casting somebody like Judy Dench, you assume she can do anything. But that has to be a consideration at times. Is this person capable of stretching in this direction or that direction?
Well, it meant, because I knew Judy was going to be in it, it meant that when I read the script...
You immediately imagined her.
Well, I thought, oh, she'll be wonderful in this part. So I didn't have to sort of go through those worries. Mm. Yes, of course.
Although I wonder whether you ever give her line read suggestions.
Good God, no.
Oh, he gives me lots of suggestions.
Are you out of your mind? No, there are sacred territories and you don't trespass onto them.
Well, you did have her row 30 times.
No, right. Rowing's one thing, saying a line, that's her job.
He does it, he directs by stealth.
Really?
Oh, yes.
There are different director styles, aren't there? There's the Japanese director, the great Japanese director, Narase, would be asked how should I do this? And he'd say, well, I hired you for the role. You should figure it out yourself and then just sit back and worry about how the camera moved and how the lighting was working. Do you like that kind
of
director?
I'd hate that.
He made very good films anyway.
Yes, yeah, indeed. I mean, that's his way and that's admirable, but I wouldn't like to be at the other end of that.
What do you look for in a director?
Well, I need to know the way. I need to know how to do it. And the painful thing in the theatre, of course, is that you work with a director for so many weeks and then quite suddenly you're let walk out there and nobody interrupts. Mm-hmm. I hate that. But then after a few performances in a few weeks, you don't want any of them to come back. You certainly don't want notes again.
And yet many actors tell me that as performances go on over the weeks, it changes, and sometimes it needs to be reined back in and somebody has to come there and say, wow, you're going over the top in the second act.
I remember Peter Hall coming after we'd done about 6 weeks of Antony and Cleopatra at the National, and he came back and he just said the most wonderful thing. He said, it's got a little bit baroque. And I thought, oh, that's the most marvellous note. Then you know how it applies right across the... You know, when it's wonderful if you have that kind of shorthand. And that is what Stephen has. And when I say by stealth, he is able to suggest in the minimum amount of way of how something should be, you know. It's thrilling to work like that.
You also have to be concerned that you don't squelch someone.
Well, that would be ridiculous, wouldn't it?
You have to suggest that they move in a certain direction, but not by... Some directors actually direct through humiliation, don't they?
I hope not.
Well, supposedly Otto Preminger did.
Michel Saint-Denis.
And to some degree Hitchcock, I gather, who considered all actors to be cows.
Idiots.
Well, it's been my experience that actors are generally very bright people, very smart people. In fact, it takes intelligence to really do what you do.
That's what I think. I think they're very, very bright, and I think if you treat them any other way, you know, if you don't respect that, you're daft, I think.
This does seem like a real difference after the last film, Dirty Pretty Things, which was about as dark as anything could be. Do you sometimes need to have a kind of a change of pace?
I think all the time you need that. I mean, it's very, very demanding making a film and suddenly to be asked to do something completely different or have some kind of holiday or... It's the best thing in the world.
Well, there was a time when the films had a certain kind of thematic sensibility. My Beautiful Laundrette, followed by Prick Up Your Ears and Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. And then there were the Irish films, the Snapper and The Van and Mary Riley.
No, you find afterwards there are sort of patterns that you've fallen into and the films somehow group themselves together, but I come to the end of a film and then want to do something completely different, completely fresh.
And then you've done the American films.
Yes.
The Grifters.
Yes.
There was High-Low Country.
Yes.
There was High Fidelity.
Mm.
Hero with Dustin Hoffman.
Yes.
Again, I assume it's a very different experience than working in Britain.
Well, of course, yes.
It's
not so much the Hollywood thing. For me, working in America is such a treat and such a privilege. Of course, when you go back to England, I don't really know anything about American society, so I wouldn't presume to make a film, really about America. They all seem to me to be to do with earlier films.
Well, a film like High Fidelity could be British, could be American.
High Fidelity,
in fact,
course,
it came out of a British novel.
Of course, it was a British novel, so that really doesn't count. But I can see that when I go back to England, I'm somehow more involved in English society because I live there and my life is there.
And you've, Judy, you've been all over the place in other ways, comedy, television series. You've played in a number of James Bond films. And then there have been all of the sorts of films, the projects that we associate with a person who is a dame. So,
what does that mean?
Oh, I hope not.
You know, those all that Shakespeare stuff and a handful of dust.
Oh, you don't have to be a dame to play Shakespeare.
Room with a View.
I've been doing Shakespeare
proper
for 48 years.
You mean proper stuff. Yes. Well,
yes,
you're quite right. That is the proper stuff. That's proper. That is improper.
I get a feeling at times that you're happier playing M than you are some of those other things.
I like playing M, but then it's quite different. I mean, if you were to ask me what would I want to do this evening, I would say straight away I want to go to the theatre and do Absolute Hell, which is a play I did at the National and on television, and I absolutely doted on every single minute of playing it.
Well, you were here in New York with a play some years ago. I've forgotten the
Amy's View.
Yeah, it was just extraordinary, and I wonder why we don't see you more on the Broadway stage.
Well, I'm going to be in the British Theatre. I'm going to be in the West End next year, and at Stratford.
I forgot to mention that you're also in the new film of Pride and Prejudice.
Yes.
Playing an evil person. Not evil, but not a likable person.
Not a likable person at all.
Now, why would you be cast in that?
I can't imagine. Meanwhile, quite lovable in Mrs. Henderson Presents, which opens Friday the 9th at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, and the Angelica stars Judy Dench, Bob Hoskins. I didn't mention the young woman, what's her name, Riley?
Kelly Riley.
Kelly Riley, who plays the lead nude show girl, but is quite wonderful.
Yes, she's a wonderful, wonderful actress, wonderful girl.
And meanwhile, I would like to thank you both so much for being here. I look forward to the next time you stop by, because it's always a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Do you have another film in the works?
I'm making a film at the moment, yes.
And you said you're going on the London stage.
Yes.
Well,
back to work.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.